From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Secretary of Labor convenes his fashion forum, what many are calling the Sweatshop Summit. We'll have a debate on corporate responsibility.
Okay, the Union Carbide Corporation killed all those people. The stock is up. So it didn't harm the ability of didn't harm the stock. It went down for a while, but now it's back up.
That's correct.
What does that reveal to us?
What that reveals is that people who are investing in Union Carbide
don't give a damn, huh?
That is essentially correct. They value more the value that they will receive from that investment than what they perceive to be a marginal impact on a decision that, let's face it, happened in India.
Then another look at corporate power, slap suits.
And we coined that term to try and capture the use of lawsuits to silence political speech. Citizens who speak to their own government and then find themselves sued for doing so by people who are not wanting them to communicate effectively with the government.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Trying to reach out to female and young voters and transcend bitter GOP differences over abortion, Bob Dole has picked New York Congresswoman Susan Molinari, who supports abortion rights, to deliver the keynote address at next month's Republican convention. Molinari is a conservative Republican from Staten Island, the whitest and most conservative borough of New York City. She's also in the House leadership and an ally of Newt Gingrich. On the subject of a running mate, Dole acknowledged that his campaign has done a preliminary interview with Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge, who is also pro-choice. He says he has emerged as a first-tier prospect. Dole himself spoke for 20 minutes on Sunday with another prospect, Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson, but aides to both men said the vice presidential nomination did not come up. And Bob Dole is hearing it from one of his own. New York Senator Alphonse D'Amato says Dole's Republican presidential campaign has made major mistakes. D'Amato says in today's New York Post he's unhappy Dole skipped last week's NAACP convention. The senator also says he's upset about Dole's changes on how to handle the abortion issue in the GOP platform and his suggestion that smoking isn't addictive to some people. Republican rebel Pat Buchanan angrily sniped at rival Bob Dole's presidential campaign aides yesterday, calling them little twerps whose service to the GOP pales next to his own. And human rights and labor advocates demanding that Nike improve pay and conditions for its contract workers in Indonesia rallied outside a sports shoe store yesterday to start a week of protests against the sporting goods company. We'll have more on that story tomorrow. And you're listening to Democracy Now! This morning, the Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, is convening his fashion forum in Virginia. Many are calling the event the Sweatshop Summit. It follows his testimony yesterday before a subcommittee on child labor. He testified along with entertainer Kathy Lee Gifford. Today, we have a debate on corporate responsibility. We begin with John Hood. He's author of the book, The Heroic Enterprise, Business and the Common Good. He is a former Bradley Fellow at the Heritage Foundation here in Washington, D.C., and is president of the John Locke Foundation, a think tank in Raleigh, North Carolina. John Hood, why don't we begin with the thesis of your book, The Heroic Enterprise?
Well, the thesis of my book is in many ways a defense of the corporation as an institution and a free enterprise as an institution against a lot of the criticisms that have been lodged in the past few years that corporations sacrifice the interests of consumers and workers and others at the expense of greed, that corporations are engaged in a unprecedented downsizing and reduction of opportunities for workers and things like that. I basically challenge all of those on factual grounds. And I also argue that corporations fulfill their responsibilities best when they seek to maximize profits and return value to shareholders and to consumers.
And how does that guarantee a safer workplace or a safer environment?
Well, safer workplace is a good example because workplace accidents are extremely costly affairs. It costs you a lot of money when you lose production, when you lose a talented employee that has to be sidelined or replaced and the replacement retrained. You lose a lot of money in liability. You raise your costs for workers' compensation insurance and other insurance costs when you pay no attention to safety. And the bottom line is that these incentives for managers to worry about workplace safety, in my view, far outweigh the somewhat unlikely prospect of actually being fined by OSHA, which is not an argument for increasing OSHA fines. It's an argument that in the last analysis, the economic incentives in favor of safety are very strong and work most of the time.
And we're also joined by Richard Grossman. He's co-director of the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, and he's put out a pamphlet called Taking Care of Business, Citizenship, and the Charter of Incorporation. You bring a slightly different perspective to the issue of corporations.
I think we disagree about the fundamental purpose and nature of particularly the large today's large corporation. I don't think it's a wealth generator as much as it is a consolidator of wealth, of other people's wealth, and a consolidator of power. And I think that it's important for people nowadays, is particularly that large corporations have amassed so much economic power and have changed that into political power as well, to consider what is the nature of the corporation, what should it be, and what should be the legal relationship between us as the sovereign people and these artificial entities. In his book, Mr. Hood quotes Milton Friedman, talking about just profits and the responsibilities of businessmen. But Friedman says, I have from an article he wrote in the New York Times a couple of years ago, he says it's the responsibility of corporations to make as much money as possible while conforming to the basic rules of society, both those embodied in law and those embodied in ethical custom. But I think the problem is that, in fact, the corporation, the large corporations, are writing the rules. They're writing the laws. They're electing the people at local, state, and federal office. They're educating the judges. They're really not just sticking to their purpose for which they're chartered. They are, in fact, rewriting the rules of society. And under those conditions, they're decreasing competition and basically preventing people from doing what it is we need to do in order to protect our community. So I think, on the whole, the very large corporations have been playing a very negative role in the society for over 100 years.
I happen to own some shares through my retirement plan of all sorts of large corporations. And I like it when large corporations make profits and return dividends and capital gains to me, because that means that I'm going to be able to retire. Of course, Social Security will probably not be around when I retire, so I need the wealth generation that corporations, large or small, generate in order for me as an individual who is not wealthy and will never be wealthy to have a comfortable and happy life. Now, the point about writing the rules, I think, is actually a legitimate point, because corporations do play a significant political role, not a direct role in campaign finance, of course, but certainly an indirect role, and corporate executives do play a very important role. But I think this is an artifact of the size of our government. I think that government tries to do too much and is involved in too many things. And naturally, corporations will attempt to manipulate that process to help themselves. And there are many, many examples of corporations that use government power to protect themselves from competition.
So when a large corporation causes harm, such as 11 years ago, the Union Carbide Corporation in a single night killed over 10,000 people in Bhopal, India, and many, many more people died subsequently and others have been permanently injured. I'm wondering what should be the sanctions against this corporation. They still haven't been to trial. There still hasn't been a trial. They still haven't faced the bar of justice. What should happen to a corporation when it causes major harm like that?
Well, the answer is pretty clear, that when the corporation engages in malfeasance that affects neighbors or other innocent bystanders or workers and damages their interests, then they should be held liable for that. The problem, of course, is that the Bhopal disaster did not occur in the United States. And you're held
Union
hostage.
But Union Carbide is chartered in New York State, so what? It's chartered here.
It doesn't make any difference. Chartering is simply a legal permission, a legal stamp of approval on an agreement that's already been made between private contractors.
I disagree strongly about that. The chartering the corporation has historically in this country been a subordinate entity, an artificial entity, and through the charters and the state corporation codes, and in some cases through state constitutions, the sovereign people have in fact defined the corporation And historically, the states reserve the right to amend and revoke the charters of corporations and to dissolve them. And
that is correct, of course, but the point is the history of the corporation, you're absolutely right, was originally a government creation. The corporation was a government creation. But that has evolved tremendously since the kings and queens made corporations.
No, we're now talking about 50... this country, not the kings or queens. In this country, the states chartered the corporations. We didn't have a king after the American Revolution.
That is correct. The people, in very serious and important ways, own corporations.
Which people is that? The stockholders?
That is correct.
But stockholders have very few rights.
I am a stockholder. If I choose not to...
Over the last 15, 20 years, as I'm sure you know well, stockholder rights have been trampled upon mercilessly. They don't really have a say in what takes place within a large corporation.
John.
Well, of course they do. They can leave. This is the fundamental...
Yeah, but how does that change the corporation? They leave, but the corporate harms still continue.
It's very simple. If you're taking an action that discourages people from owning your stock... The value of your stock will go down.
Hey,
look
at the cigarette corporations. There are very few entities in this world that do as much harm as the cigarette corporations. How's the stock been doing lately?
I'm from North Carolina. Do you think I believe that tobacco companies are doing harm? Doing more harm than any other institution? I think that that people have the right to smoke, and that this is a voluntary choice, and I believe in freedom, and I do not believe that.
Okay, the Union Carbide Corporation killed all those people. That stock is up. So it didn't harm the ability of didn't harm the stock. It went down for a while, but now it's back up.
That's correct.
What does that reveal to us?
What that reveals is that people who are investing in Union Carbide
don't give a damn, huh?
That is essentially correct. They value more the value that they will receive from that investment than what they perceive to be a marginal impact on a decision that, let's face it, happened in India. This is not.
Those were human beings.
You're absolutely right.
11,000 human beings.
Right, but if that fire had occurred in my home state or some other state, it would obviously be the state's responsibility to protect its citizens against harm. It is India's responsibility to protect its citizens against harm. And if you're arguing that Union Carbide is using its political power to stymie India from doing that, I would probably agree with you. But this is a different issue.
How about Imperial Food Products, which in North Carolina in 1991, 25 people died at a fire in the poultry plant. The state fined the company $800,000, or about $32,000 per life. You think that's appropriate?
Well, there was no need for a fine. I don't know if you're aware of this, but Imperial Products was destroyed by the fire. I mean, the fact that you fined somebody after the fact.
So who takes responsibility for the awfulness that happened?
Well, number one,
isn't that one of the roles of corporations, in order to shield the human beings, the people who try to make money from them, who are making money, and the decision makers, to shield them from any real legal responsibility?
My argument is that OSHA regulation, and I'll use the Hamlet case as an example, is never going to get their attention as much as the fact that firm has been destroyed by very bad management and some bad regulation.
People who were killed.
Well, of course. You don't live in a perfect world, and there are always accidents. What you want to do is you want to deter future accidents by making it extremely financially costly to have an accident. We have such a system today. I guarantee you, I have friends who are employers in North Carolina who, after the fire,
unlocked their doors.
Well, they weren't going to have locked doors. That was fairly unique, but they did look very closely at their safety procedures to make sure they wouldn't face a similar situation.
I hope so.
It was not because they were going to be fined $500,000 or $800,000. It was because they did not want to have their entire plant destroyed and all of these lives and all the bad publicity and the lawsuits and everything else and the higher insurance costs if they ever were able to do business again. There are so many incentives that overwhelm the government regulation here that I just don't think it matters.
We're talking to John Hood, who's author of The Heroic Enterprise, Business and the Common Good. He is president of the John Locke Foundation, a think tank in Raleigh, North Carolina. And we're also joined by Richard Grossman, co-director of the program on corporations, law, and democracy. I have to go back for a second to the Bhopal case because I think your response will stun many. Corporations are global entities now, wherever they may be chartered. Do you really think that they should be shielded from responsibility because while they're based here, their factory was in India? I mean, is it appalling to you that they killed more than 10,000 people? And what do you think should happen to, is it Warren Anderson, who was the CEO at the time of Union Carbide?
Sure.
Do you think he should have been thrown in jail?
in the American system?
In an American jail or in an Indian jail?
Possibly. I really am not a legal expert on these matters, and wouldn't want anybody to get away with doing anything that is malfeasance that leads to somebody's death or 10,000 deaths. I think that to examine the Bhopal case as an example of corporate responsibility is to dramatically miss the point. Those are very isolated types of accidents. What corporations do every day is create goods and services that people want, employ people, train people, generate all sorts of wonderful things.
Well, then what about going, once again, to the tobacco industry? 400,000 people die a year of tobacco-related illness.
That's right.
This is not an exception to the rule. This is the rule.
That's right.
So what do you think should happen to the tobacco? What kind of responsibility does the tobacco industry bear? For example, what do you think of the attorneys general around the country that are suing the tobacco industry, saying you should be responsible for our health care costs, for our Medicaid costs that we are having to pay as a result of your products?
I think that's nonsense, because for that suit to win would simply be a field day to attack every single corporation or company or business that does anything that has a health impact.
For a point of clarification, Richard Grossman, what would you change right now for corporations? How would you change law?
Just to say, up until the 1880s, before the Supreme Court made that switch, corporations were not considered persons and didn't have civil rights. The persons didn't have Bill of Rights protections. I mean, I think that one of the most important sources of corporate power today is that they're considered persons under the law, and they have First Amendment protections. They have Fourth Amendment, the right from unreasonable search and seizure. They have 14th Amendment protections, the right to equal protection of the laws. Now, as I just said before, that's the justification, the rationalization for corporations giving money to candidates, advertising on elections and issues of public policy, and lobbying, setting up all these front nonprofit corporations like trade associations to hire lawyers and lobbyists to go ahead and actually write the laws and influence our lawmakers.
But John Hood is saying, in fact, these are people behind these corporations who are doing all this.
If corporations weren't persons, then the CEO on his or her own time, just like every other normal citizen, could go and meet with his congressman or out of his own pocket could give money. That certainly would be appropriate. All individual human beings, citizens, can do that. But for the entity of the corporation to use shareholder money and to use its great power to involve itself in the basic mechanisms of the democratic process, elections and lawmaking and education of the public, I think is totally inappropriate. And so, frankly, from my point of view, the personhood doctrine needs to be overturned, just as the separate but equal doctrine was overturned by the Supreme Court.
But I think we have to recognize that in this world, that a corporation not only concentrates wealth, it also concentrates power, and that distorts the political process, and it gives advantage to people who are wealthy and to people who can't participate in that, to poorer people. They don't have the advantage of all of this power.
I actually quite agree with that. I think that that people with money will always dominate politics. I think anything you do short of getting rid of the First Amendment would have no effect on that. Because if I've got $1 million and I want to spend it to try to tell people to vote my way, I'm always going to hustle somebody with $1,000. Do I think that is correctable? I do not, under a free society. Therefore, it is my argument that we should constrain what we expect from politics and treat it as the corrupt, inherently corrupt institution that it is.
I think you're really trivializing the enormous amount of money from corporate coffers that go to lobbying, not necessarily directly to the, you know, to buy lunches and whatever for the elected officials, but to all the thousands of corporate front organizations and to groups like the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute to produce all kinds of documents with corporate money to shape the public debate, to put out, you know, false and misleading opinions and all that. And that's the way that corporations for the last over 100 years have in fact been shaping public consciousness and public education, really involving themselves in colonizing people's minds, so that today, you know, you have a lot of people feeling there's no alternative to the big corporations, even though they experience the enormous amount of harm and suffering that comes from what corporations are putting out into the air, the poisons they're putting out into the air and the water, and the perversion of the democratic process, and their destabilizing of communities all over the country.
Well, First of all, the Heritage Foundation receives about 5% of its funding from corporations, the vast majority of it from individuals, probably wealthy individuals, but definitely individuals. Number two, corporations give a lot more
usually
money.
Usually probably wealthy individuals who were made wealthy by their involvement in corporations.
Or they could have inherited it, right? I mean, who cares? The point is, yes, think tanks raise money from people with money. Well, you know, actually, Heritage Foundation is the broadest supported think tank in the United States in terms of how many people give. But the point is, corporations as institutions, which I think is our point here, play a very minor role in funding any sort of public policy organization, with the possible exception of the American Enterprise Institute.
Oh, how about the, but I'm
secondly,
talking about groups like the Chemical Manufacturers Association,
yes,
and the forestry associations. I mean, all of the industry, so the chlorine association, when they needed to start defending chlorine, all of a sudden they had $50 million in their bank account.
Okay, the second point is that corporate donations primarily, inordinately, go to left-of-center organizations versus right-of-center organizations, the large corporations anyway. Now, this only means...
Name me an example of a left-of-center organization that gets
NAACP, environmental organizations, the Urban League. These organizations get a lot more corporate money. And I'm not saying they're better funded. I'm only saying that they get a lot more money from corporate entities than conservative or free market organizations do. So just on the face of it, your statement is inaccurate.
What about the chemical
But the trade associations, you're absolutely right.
That's where the real money is.
Well, that is correct. A great deal of political power and lobbying power is concentrated in trade associations, which are funded both by corporations and by individuals, proprietors and partnerships.
They're mostly funded by, I bet they're 80-90% funded by corporations.
Well, that depends upon the association you're talking about.
We have to break. We'll be back in a minute to continue this debate. John Hood, president of the John Locke Foundation, a think tank in Raleigh, North Carolina. And we're speaking with Richard Grossman, co-director of Corporations, Law, and Democracy. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we'll be taking a look at one case study of corporate power in this country and around the world. We'll be taking a look at Nike. This follows today's summit, the Sweatshop Summit, convened by the Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich. I'm Amy Goodman, and right now we continue our debate on corporate responsibility. Our guests, John Hood, author of The Heroic Enterprise, Business and the Common Good, and Richard Grossman, who's co-director of a program in Massachusetts called Corporations, Law, and Democracy. And Richard, you had a question for John Hood.
Yeah, I'm wondering if, Mr. Hood, if you think that there's any entity in the country that really has authority over the corporation. That, I mean, corporations, the people who run corporations are making very important decisions that affect the not just the air and the water and the labor, you know, what kind of work is done, but really affects the culture and the way people think. Is there any entity in this country that has authority over that? You know, who's this? You know, when a giant corporation with great technological capacity and great wealth makes a certain decision to do something that has enormous repercussions, is there any? You know, do they have any? I mean, what is our role as the sovereign people in all this?
Well, I think it's very clear. First of all, I do not think that anybody is sovereign over me as a citizen of the United States in taking certain actions that do not violate the rights of anybody else. Okay, so number one, I do not respect sovereignty of the people over me. This is a fundamental constitutional question of do you have the right to tell me what to do, as long as what I am doing is not violating your rights. So yes, absolutely, the corporations are governed by local, state, and federal governments when those corporate actions violate the rights of its citizens. And absolutely when that happens, the government has authority over the corporation.
But in reality today, our states are not exercising, well, and the federal government are exercising very little authority. In fact, most of the harms that giant corporations are doing today are treated as legal. And when a corporation does a horrible harm, you know, the worst that can happen is that they get a big fine, which they then deduct from their taxes. So, you know, it's the giant corporations that are really shaping the culture and shaping society. How are we as the sovereign people, all of us together as citizens, how are we supposed to shape our lives and shape our communities when so much power, political power, is really wielded by these artificial entities that are called corporations?
A corporation cannot make me work for them. They can't make me buy a product from them.
No, but they can limit your choices enormously.
They can pollute the air so that you are forced to breathe it.
Of course, and that is not a permissible activity.
But it happens all the time.
It needs to be policed, but that's a different. That's not the same thing.
Let me ask you something. You're from the Heritage Foundation. After the Republican victory in 1994, the freshman Republicans went over to the Heritage Foundation for their training to become Congress members for the first time. One of their main goals is to gut the regulatory agencies because they feel that they limit free enterprise. Mm-hmm. They say they want to engage in this devolution of power to the states. Mm-hmm. Now, people like Noam Chomsky say the reason they want to give these powers to the state, take them away from the federal government, is that there is no power at the state level that is strong enough to regulate these massive multinational corporations. And so what they're in effect doing is just allowing these corporations free reign by taking power away from the federal government, the only entity that is can be any kind of check on the power of corporations. So on the one hand, you say we as citizens have the right to regulate corporations, but you come from the very foundation that is trying to gut all the agencies that would regulate these corporations.
I mean, there's no inconsistency in saying that the government has an authority over protecting the environment and other rights of individuals. And to say that, for example, a particular agency spends too much money or does it the wrong way or is excessive or burdensome.
This is not just excessive or does it the wrong way. They're trying to completely wipe out the EPA, completely wipe out the FDA.
Well, let's take this issue apart a little bit. Number one, many, many large corporations would much prefer, if you follow the politics on this very closely, you will see that large corporations do not want to be regulated by 51 different entities and have to deal with them. They would much rather have the federal government preempt all those regulations and, yes, probably cut the best deals they can get. So large corporations are not always in favor or even frequently in favor of devolving regulatory power or certainly legal liability to the states. They would much rather deal with one entity.
Right. They spent 100 years taking the power away from the states and putting it in the federal government, frankly.
I actually agree with that. I think the states need to play a much greater role in our public.
But that means the states have to have real authority. It means that the chartering process and the state incorporation code, the state incorporation codes, have to be enforced. And they have to, you know, when a corporation misuses its trust and exceeds its authority, and violates the terms of its charter and really of the body politic as a whole, then the state has to have the ability to sanction that corporation in a serious way without causing a revolution. And I think the only really serious sanction that corporate leaders are going to understand is that the states need to start revoking charters when corporations can engage in harmful activities either to life, to property, or to the democratic process. How can the states really be effective unless they have actual authority to do something to these corporations?
States can fine them. They can imprison the corporate manager. I mean, I don't understand what chartering would have any. Would
how
make
often
any big
has
deal.
A state imprisoned a corporate manager ahead of an organization? I mean, there are some who argue that look at the emphasis of crime on the street and you say how much harm that does people who rob others, et cetera, on the street. But if you look at corporate crime, at white collar crime, in fact, much more money is taken away. We're talking about hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, and much more harm is done. And yet very few corporate executives have ever gone to jail. Do you think that's a problem? Do you think that's why people in America are losing faith in corporations?
Well, I don't think that's the reason Americans are losing faith in corporations. I think that's primarily a media-driven phenomenon. But I do think that corporate executives, when they take actions that harm others, harm their rights, their constitutional legal rights, and the courts prove that managers are responsible, corporations financially responsible. To the extent to which this is not adequately prosecuted, it needs to be.
Do you think it's a problem when corporations lie, like companies from your own home state? Actually, I don't know where Philip Morris is incorporated or Brown and Williamson.
I think they're in Virginia or
but
something.
But what about the 30, 40 years of clearly lying, for example, saying that nicotine is not addictive, when whatever you think, and I assume you don't think it's addictive, the documents that have come out of these companies clearly state that nicotine is addictive, and they have been saying otherwise for 40 years.
Well, I think that nicotine is addictive, as many other products are, many other activities are. I am just very uncomfortable with the government deciding what people are and are not going to do. Because today, I'm not a smoker myself.
Are you uncomfortable with governments deciding what people should and should not know?
No, you're absolutely right. The extent to which corporations have engaged in knowing falsehoods, whether it's selling their products, whether it's promoting their products, that is that's something for which they should be liable. So,
asbestos is not a voluntary choice like smoking, and the record is clear that from internal documents from the Johns Manville Corporation, that their officials knew that asbestos caused cancer 30 and 40 and 50 years ago and didn't reveal that.
Yes.
I believe they
got punished, didn't they?
No, they didn't. They declared bankruptcy and reorganized and saved the company and protected the company from most of the lawsuits. It's a very limited sum that is being sought now.
I actually think we do need to reform bankruptcy laws, by the way.
What about President Clinton's White House meeting on corporate responsibility? What did you think about that?
I thought it was very silly because
we agree on that.
Well, probably for different reasons, but I thought it was silly because you don't evaluate corporate responsibility, in my view, according to whether firms provide certain types of health benefits, training, et cetera. In my view, responsibility has to do with what goods and services are produced and whether people want them, whether people like them, and whether they're providing social benefits. And I just think that was the wrong focus. And furthermore, that it was that to argue that we're in favor of voluntarily encouraging corporations to adopt better management practices sounds great, but I don't think it squares with their actual agenda to use the tax code and the regulatory code to coerce firms to do what they want.
Do you think it would have been more honest if President Clinton laid out the records of the companies that he invited? For example, I'm looking at the Preamble Collaborative. This is a group in Washington's list of the corporations and what they've done. WMX, subject of criminal investigations and antitrust suits in at least 17 states, cited over 600 times by the EPA for pollution violations from 1980 to 1990. Its subsidiary pled guilty to 6 felony violations of environmental laws, the largest criminal Superfund case ever, paid $28 million in settlements and fines between 1980 and 92 for price fixing, bid rigging, price gouging. That's just WMX, just one of the 73 or whatever the number was corporations represented. Then there was Lockheed Martin, called Lockmart fondly by people in the business, laid off 100,000 workers from 1980 to 95, accrued more OSHA fines than any other aerospace company from 88 to 93, demanded that employees forego all claims against the company for labor law violations in order to be eligible for early retirement packages. You think it would have been more honest to talk about WMX, Lockheed Martin, United Technologies, et cetera, in this way, to say what their real records were about?
Well, yeah, but that would kind of vitiate against the purpose of the photo opportunity. The examples you listed there, I mean, some of those things concern me, and some of them do not. I mean, I think that, once again, violating environmental laws is obviously one thing. Laying off workers is another. I'm very uncomfortable with equating a violation of rights with a decision about employment. You don't have a right to work at a particular firm.
Right. Well, I'm not talking about breaking the law. That would be an issue of corporate responsibility.
Yeah.
If you're looking at workers laid off versus CEOs making millions off of laying off those workers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of that's just media nonsense.
That's the second or third time you referred to sort of media nonsense.
Yeah.
What we're talking about here is the corporate press. I mean, there are very few the corporations that own and run the major media, whether it's television, radio, press, magazines, are giant global corporations. So So they're not just Joe down the street that publishes a little newsletter. We're talking about giant corporations.
In fact, you seem to dismiss a whole lot of stuff. Richard, let me just say that I did not get this from the liberal media that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I got this in spite of that media because these are media conglomerates.
I'm actually not arguing that it's a liberal media, so let me make myself clear. I think that we focus, and this is not an ideological point, it's a question of the news business. The news business focuses on individual cases because it's more interesting as a news product. You're not going to, you know, for example, you look at a firm that lays off lots of work, 40,000 workers in the case of AT&T. Well, obviously that very day there were many, 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 many firms that added many more than 40,000 workers all totaled. We're not going to report that. It's not a news story.
Name one firm that added 40,000 people?
No, of course not. No, I'm not talking about a single firm adding. I'm talking about many more than 40,000 jobs would be created during that same period by many other firms. There was not a net loss of 40,000 jobs to the economy. But the loss occurs in big chunks. A firm lays off 40,000 workers, and that's a news story. If, you know, 400 employers add the similar number, total number of workers. You can't do a story on 400 different employers.
Wait a second.
Hiring.
I think there are two things going on here. One is you may lose 40,000 of these kinds of jobs and get 40,000 others, and they may not be the same quality of jobs.
That's right.
But number two, should the CEO get a bonus for doing that?
Sure. If it increased profitability of the firm, absolutely. That's his job. His job is not to employ people. His job is to maximize value for shareholders. Sometimes that involves hiring people. Sometimes it involves not hiring or firing people.
But sometimes a corporation, especially these days, is not even necessarily going to be made more profitable by laying off those workers. It's a kind of corporate anorexia that people are talking about these days. It's just the fashion, even if it means being less profitable.
No, that's right, actually. Many corporations have gone too far with layoffs and have tried to do too much with that particular tool in reducing their costs and have paid a price. The price is paid in the area of profit margin and whether you're offering competitive returns. I think the market self-corrects for that. If corporations make those bad decisions, they definitely pay a price.
Richard Grossman, any comments on the issue of laying off workers? I mean, should it be illegal?
No, I don't have comments on that. Mr. Hood and I have a very different conceptual notions about the nature of the corporation and the nature of us as a free people. And it's my sense that giant corporations and democracy are incompatible, and that we have these giant entities that are essentially functioning as governments that are shaping our societies. And we as the free people have very little control over them and very little we are exercising very little authority over them, contrary to the intentions of the founders of this country. And I think we need to act on that, and so I guess I found much of this conversation very unsatisfactory.
Well, let me just ask one thing as we end. In a few minutes, in a nutshell, can you summarize what it is you'd like to see in place of what we have right now?
Well, I think that through our local, state, and federal governments, and primarily through our local and state governments, I think we need to exercise real authority to define the corporation. That if we're going to give these entities the enormous political powers that they have, and investment powers and authority, then we need to define them in very specific terms. So that if people want to come together to form a corporation to make paper, they can make paper, but not write the rules to make paper, not write the environmental laws and the labor laws and all that. And if they want to abide by the rules that are set by the people, then they'll get a charter. And if they violate that charter, then they'll cease to exist. And I think, you know, and the corporations should not have any role in elections, should not have any role in lawmaking, they shouldn't have any role in shaping public policy debate, they shouldn't be influencing our universities and our education. Their role is should be very limited. And we the people have to act as sovereign citizens, and we have to take responsibility. We're the ones who have to be socially responsible by controlling all the institutions that we create to help us do our work. And I think, in fact, what we have is the sorcerer's apprentice, that we created these corporations in order to help us do work, and the corporations have recreated the circumstances of their own existence, and now under law they have more rights and powers than people do, and they have plenty of very smart people like Mr. Hood who come along and have all kinds of very clever theories to justify why we as a free people have no authority over these corporations. And our only choice is to try to regulate them around the edges or ask corporate executives, please, please, you know, don't cause too much harm. Please be responsible. Please be a little nicer. When corporations are raping and pillaging in this country and around the world, and I think think if people are concerned about the nature of corporate power, then we have to focus on who really is in charge in this country, who's going to shape our country and our culture, these corporations or us as human beings.
Can you tell us how to get in touch with the program on corporations, law, and democracy?
Sure, they can get in touch with us at Post Office Box 806, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02140.
One more time.
Box 806, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02140.
On that note, we're going to have to wrap up. I want to thank John Hood, author of The Heroic Enterprise, Business and the Common Good, and president of the John Locke Foundation. How can people get in touch with you?
We're in North Carolina, and our telephone number is 919-828-3876.
Again?
919-828-3876.
And we did a little checking. John Hood, author of The Heroic Enterprise, was a former Bradley Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. We checked People for the American's Ways Guide, Buying a Movement, Right-Wing Foundations in American Politics, and it says on the Lynn and Harry Bradley Foundation that it illustrates the power of a well-financed foundation. Harry Bradley was an active member of the John Birch Society. It became a major foundation when it bought Rockwell International, when it was bought by Rockwell International Corporation. Sponsors. It funds the National Empowerment Television and was one of the funders of Charles Murray's book, The Bell Curve. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, a look at slap suits. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. And today we're joined by two people, George Pring and Penelope Kanaan. They are professors of law and sociology at the University of Denver and have written a very interesting and I would say scary book. It's called Slaps, Getting Sued for Speaking Out. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
And why don't we begin by you explaining exactly what a slap is, as you've coined the term.
Well, SLAPS is an acronym that stands for Strategic Lawsuits Against Public Participation. And we coined that term to try and capture the use of lawsuits to silence political speech. Citizens who speak to their own government and then find themselves sued for doing so by people who are not wanting them to communicate effectively with the government.
Now, as you write in your book, there's all sorts of forms of slap suits. I mean, they can be libel, they can be, what else?
Well, that's one of the interesting questions, because lawyers for years have been putting things in little boxes and little categories like libel, slander, business interference. And the only problem with that is that then you don't see the forest, you just see the trees. So what we did was to take a cross-checked look at a lot of these different kinds of lawsuits attacking citizens who had spoken out to government, and suddenly realized they were really all the same lawsuit, no matter what conventional categories lawyers were putting them in.
I think the power of your book is the stories of the citizens who thought they were taking responsible citizen action and ended up being sued. Some successfully sued and others won their suits, although they were terrified in the process. Can you tell us some of their stories? And why don't you begin with the story you begin with in your book, the story of Betty Johnson?
Yeah, Betty Johnson was a housewife in a town called Louisville near Denver. And she was in the kitchen, I think, literally washing dishes when a neighbor came over to her and said, come on, let's go to a public hearing. There's a developer who wants to change the zoning and annex some land. And let's just go see what it's about. When she went to the public hearing, she started asking questions to the city council about this proposal. And many of her questions were of the sort that all citizens should want to know about, and that is, how much is it going to cost the citizens for such things as police protection, public bus system, the school buses, and how much is it going to change our taxes if we're going to annex this land? And the city council couldn't provide her with the with full enough answers for her. And so as she pressed further, she left there and went and did a survey of citizens. She then gathered signatures on petitions to try and get a stop to this proposal until some of these questions could be answered properly. Her vigilance as a citizen was responded to by the developer with a lawsuit for more than $1 million for, I think it was, libel and interference with economic advantage. The purpose, however, of this was to get Betty Johnson to stop her her citizen vigilance, if you will, and to just be quiet and let the proposal go through.
In fact, she had won, right? The citizens, the more than 90% of the neighbors who didn't want this to go through, succeeded in getting it turned around.
Well, that's right. That's one of the things that makes this such a classic case. Betty Johnson's case has been replicated just in the last 20 years by literally hundreds of similar lawsuits against thousands of Americans who have done nothing more than exercise their most basic civil right in the book, which is the right to engage in political speech, tell the government what you think, ask the government questions, then get sued by the government or some third party, in this case, Medema Holmes. The slap cases are losers. In other words, Betty Johnson, the victims, tend to win 90% or more of the time, but they can extract a terrible toll in terms of time and dollars and stress and, in this particular case, broken marriages.
First of all, the four neighbors who were sued were lucky in that the American Civil Liberties Union said they would take on the case, but if they hadn't, wouldn't they have to have paid a lawyer, hired a lawyer to protect them?
Yes, indeed, and that is one of the real problems. The ACLU chapters across the country have been really heroic in taking on these cases because they are flat-out First Amendment attack cases, but they can't be everywhere for everybody. And so a lot of lawyers have taken these cases on in a defense. Some have done it even for free in the expectation that when they successfully got the slap dismissed against the citizens, they could then turn the case around and file multi-million dollar slap backs against the developers or the others who had for violating their civil rights.
That involved a real estate developer. What about people who criticize the government? Has the government ever sued a citizen for criticizing it?
For us, this is the ultimate slap. We find about 20% of the cases that we know of to be instances where the government sues its own citizens for speaking out. West Contra Costa County Sanitation District in California sued Alan LaPointe, a citizen activist who questioned the expansion of a landfill in just north of San Francisco, and he found himself the object of one of these lawsuits.
You really find a wide range of people. In fact, next to development, real estate development lawsuits, these government slaps are the second biggest category, as we describe in Chapter 4 of the book. And these lawsuits are brought by the government itself, officially. They're brought by government employees and government officials, and it's really a case of shoot the messenger. Here we're supposed to be a country in which the representatives are supposed to be able to talk to their representatives at all levels of government. And when the representatives don't like what they hear, sometimes they shoot back with a slap. Those cases are almost all dead losers. The courts show almost no sympathy at all for the government and frequently beat up on the slap-filing government officials pretty unmercifully.
We're talking to George Pring and Penelope Kanaan. They're authors of a new book called Slaps, Getting Sued for Speaking Out. And they are both professors at the University of Denver. Penelope Kanaan is a professor of sociology, George Pring, a professor of law. What about the suit that involved writing a letter to the President of the United States opposing a political appointment?
That's the famous or infamous McDonald versus Smith case, in which early in President Reagan's administration, when he was busily appointing new people to new jobs all over the country, a gentleman was up for consideration to be the U.S. attorney for State Back East, and a gentleman in his hometown who'd had apparently had a number of run-ins with this particular attorney didn't want him to be elevated and wrote a really, a truly vicious, vituperative, slaps are not always filed against nice people, letter to the President of the United States, calling this attorney everything under the sun, referring to him as Mad Dog Smith. And I think the ultimate calumny in the letter was this individual told the President of the United States this was the only attorney who advertised in the Yellow Pages in their hometown. Well, the attorney didn't sit still for that, did not get the job, turned around and sued Mr. McDonald for several million dollars for libel. But a libel in a letter to the President of the United States. That's what we pay them the big bucks for. That's what we pay our government officials to do, to sort out the truth from the lies, to sort out the wheat from the chaff. And ultimately, that case went all the way to the Supreme Court, was sent back down, and finally evaporated. The victim spent lots and lots of money defending himself and his notorious letter, but ultimately he succeeded in having the case dismissed.
And the story of the woman who reported workplace sexual harassment to government authorities?
Yes, I think that's the Carter versus Real case, mm-hmm. in which a woman who worked for the U.S. Air Force as a civilian employee felt that her employer had crossed the boundaries. And when she reported it to the EEOC, her boss, also a civilian employee on the Air Force base, sued her for reporting him. Now, what we see here is that sometimes it is citizens who are reporting to the government certain violations that they see, violations of law, for example, violations of environmental laws or of safe water standards, or of even school bus breaks. We find one case in Pennsylvania where parents noticed that the school, or at least they thought they saw that the school bus brakes were unsafe and squeaking. And so they reported this to the city authorities and were sued by the school bus company that had the contract with the city. The point in many of the reporting to the government slaps is that we need to have no barrier between the citizens and the government in terms of sort of monitoring the performance of not just the government, but of others of us in following the rules that are out there to protect us all. And it also turns out that we can't all be experts on those conditions. I'm not a mechanic, but if I saw the school bus brakes looking unsafe, I'd want my daughter to be protected. So we need to have citizens being able to tell the government what they see. Otherwise, we'd have to employ much more government employees to be doing the same kind of monitoring.
You both write about the large number of cases that are thrown out, although they do cause the defendants a great deal of pain, the citizens who have been sued. What about the 10% where they hold up, where the citizen loses? Can you give an example of that?
Yes, and those aren't even really losses in the sense of a court countenancing and helping in a slap. Most judges in most courts we've found take one look at these kinds of cases and realize they are being abused as well. This is judicial abuse going on as well as citizen abuse. What happens in the 10% of the cases is citizens give up. They quit. They just can't take the pressure after a year or two. They can't find a lawyer who'll help them. And they settle the case with the other side in order to get it to go away. Very, very few cases, practically just a handful, really, actually go on to trial. I was talking to someone who was involved in one that did go on to trial just last night. And in those cases, truly bizarre things can happen to the slap victims. There's a case in Michigan involving people who were trying to, actually Humane Society perfectly normal, middle-of-the-road, humane society people were trying to prevent, abuse of dogs, and they ended up losing a six-figure jury verdict to the dog pound. So there can be some very scary outcomes, but for the most part, if people stick to their guns, and the message of our book is just this, we don't want to cast an even bigger chill than the slappers themselves are doing. The message of this book is slaps are losers, slapbacks are winners. If you hang tough with your slap, get good advice, good counsel, and defend it as a violation of your First Amendment rights, you will win, and the other side will lose.
Let's get a little historical perspective on these slap suits. Would you say that their growth correlates with the growth of corporate power in this country, unbridled corporate power?
Well, what's really interesting about them is that if you look back in the law books before 1970, you find hardly any slaps that meet our simple definition. But from 1970 on, they blossom. There's a huge bulge of them. And what we correlate that with, this is our theory at least, is that the rise in slaps is basically attributable to the rise in citizen activism of the 1960s. The civil rights movement, the consumer rights movement, the environmental movement all really began to take off in the 1960s. And corporate and governmental America was certainly casting around for some way to counteract a good bit of this. And so all of a sudden, late 60s, early 70s, you start finding the corporate, government, and other slap filers resorting to the courts to beat up on their opponents.
I wanted to end on the issue of slap suits resulting from campaigning for or against a ballot issue. This is an election year. There are a lot of ballot initiatives around the country. Can you tell us that story?
Well, there's a good story in the case of Mounia versus Parnas in Santa Clara County, California. Victor Mounia was a gentleman who had been part of a taxpayers and homeowners association that had successfully fought the building of a football stadium in the backyard of their community, and went on to be sort of a good government group crossing all political lines, that then decided that maybe there had just been so much growth in the community that they pushed for a moratorium on growth, a ballot issue, and got it on the ballot. What he also did was to be the person who wrote the statement for the pamphlet that went out explaining this ballot issue. He was the person that, you know, they have a pro and a con argument in these pamphlets. And for that and for writing, for producing a flyer about the issue of too much growth, his community association and he himself were sued for $40,500,000. He was sued by a developer who would have stood to benefit from not having a moratorium on growth. His name was Parnas. In that case, Mounia sued back after the case had been dismissed, the slap itself recognized for what it was and got thrown out of court. Mounia sued back against Parnas for malicious prosecution. And he won that case. He won a sizable judgment that was appealed. He won upon appeal. And then it was appealed to the State Supreme Court of California, and he won again. Importantly, I think, that juries do understand that the loss of political rights is a very grave and loss and something that we cherish. And so juries are very willing to give punitive as well as compensatory damages to citizens who have gone through such an ordeal.
And that was George Pring and Penelope Cannon. They are both authors of Slaps, Getting Sued for Speaking Out. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with help from Erica Martinez and Pat Greenfield. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. Our director, Bill Wax. If you'd like a copy of today's show, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow, we take a look at one case study of corporate power in this country. We'll look at the Nike Corporation. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!